The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Today we are celebrating poets from Washington, D.C. And one of my favorites of all time is Brian Gilmore. Here he is with a poem.
Nosferatu. The kid in the colorful long-sleeve silk shirt. The 70s. The summer heat. Making love to the streets. Worshipping asphalt. Stay out later and later. Vampire. Throwing rocks at streetlights, alley lights, just need it to be night. For the love of the streets, just adore the streets, and malt liquor, that wonderful elixir. A mother hears a streetlight explode. She knows her boy was wearing a colorful silk shirt when he left here this evening. It's summer. People wearing long-sleeved silk shirts in summer don't think rationally. Remember the music, that crazy, ridiculous music that almost did us like the dinosaur. John Travolta doing the foxtrot, looking like he's dropped acid. Bell bottoms, stack heels, afro sprayed with something toxic. But really, it isn't the shirt. It's malt liquor, that wonderful elixir. She calls out her son's name. He's gone, like Kaiser Sosa losing his limp. Really, he's Bela Lugosi and has become a bat. Flown and jumped in someone's car, ready to worship the streets, the asphalt. He looks insane. Short shorts, long tube socks up to his knees, and his shirt, long sleeve silkness, go nowhere without it. His music, disco inferno, boogie nights, he laughs at the stuff. But another streetlight will be gone soon, he doesn't know why. And later, when the city cools off like hot apple pie, when the men drop their rods in the water on the river and pop open ice-cold bottles of Miller High Life, the kid in the colorful long sleeve silk shirt will stop by someone's house. They will pop bottles too, and a toast to malt liquor, that wonderful elixir.
That is Brian Gilmore, and I call him a cultural historian who is a poet, who is a lawyer. And he is a poet and writer, and he currently teaches at the Clinical Law Program at the Howard University School of Law in Washington, D.C., and we've known him for a long time, where he was working to help people. And I always was very impressed with that. And, you know, I always told you how much I loved the fact that people who had nowhere to go would come to you. And there's something in that that I find eternal and precious, and we love for you to do that. Now we love you teaching people to do that. This is Brian. He was actually born and raised in Washington, D.C., a graduate of Archbishop Carroll High School. I didn't actually know that.
Class of 79.
Wow, that is a very cool school. And he currently lives in Tacoma Park, Maryland, with his wife and three daughters. And now I'm going to tell my favorite anecdote, that he was once the most eligible bachelor in Washington. And I said to my husband, what happened? He said, somebody got him. Give us another poem, Brian.
Revolution for my father, Wilmer I. Gilmore. My father was a dictator. In 1968, Dad suspended the House Constitution, instituted a state of emergency, suspended any rights to television made us think we had. He declared Tarzan a fake, Nat Turner important, Malcolm X a brother we must understand. It was strange, this regime. It promulgated propaganda about the importance of reading books, the danger of always watching television, and how being black was the coolest thing you could ever know. Often my brother and I rebelled against this totalitarian despot. Mm-hmm. We declared civil war by staying out until 4 or 5 a.m. all the time. El Presidente would be awake when we returned. Calm in his demeanor, he greeted us with one of those well-prepared speeches like Fidel Castro. This constant pounding on our brains made us surrender eventually and end our unrest after nearly 20 years of disorganized resistance. Like the will of this monarch became our will. Like you will go to school. You will not mess up your life. Now when I stop by my father's house, the state of emergency is over. The revolution he declared was successful. The laws he passed are no longer in need of enforcement. These presidential duties are exclusively mine now. And if I am ever so lucky to become a dictator, I shall not hesitate to diss Tarzan and give really long speeches in another language.
Oh, Brian, I've never heard that. That's from a new manuscript.
Yes, that I've been working on for like the longest time, which is finally really complete, to tell the truth.
What's the name?
Oh, name of my new manuscript is called The George Holliday Rodney King Video. So, yeah, I know it's a weird title.
No, you are the king of titles. Listen to this. The first of his books was Elvis Presley is Alive and Well and Living in Harlem. And then he went on to prove it. Then the second book is Jungle Nights and Soda Fountain Rags, Poem for Duke Ellington. So we are ready for anything. And that second book is the only book which exists which has all poems about Ellington. As much has been written about him, I don't think there is another book that has just completely the poems about Ellington.
It's probably true, to tell the truth. I've been told that many times. Mm-hmm. And, I didn't set out to that. I just set out to write a book. I mean, I really set out with just a couple poems, and then it just went from there. And the next thing I know, I had like 30, 40 poems. And it came together as a single statement about, I'd say it's like an aesthetic biography told in verse. That's what I would like to describe it.
Did your father read it?
Yes, he read some of that, like the early poems, because I was writing those poems like early on. And him and my mother were always big fans of Duke back in the day. They used to go down to the water. They took us down to the water once to see the orchestra on the water when they used to have those shows down on the water. But they were big fans of Duke Ellington and other groups. My mother grew up in Washington, so she lived behind the Howard Theater, so it was right there.
Are they proud of you?
I guess they are. I mean, you know, you spend your life and you eventually reach the point where you say the whole reason for your life is to make your parents understand that you got them, that you understood
you got
what
the
they
message.
Were trying to say. I mean, if your parents were sending out a good message to you and you spend your whole life trying to say this is what I think that my parents would want me to do. I mean, you get those moments where you stop and you say, now, you know, I wonder what my father would do now or my mother would do now. My mother is still around, so she tells me what she would do. So you
that
always
is a love letter. That's a love letter to your father.
Right. Oh, that was written when he has heard that poem many times.
I hope
heard
so.
That poem many times.
I hope so. Right. We want to hear more from you. This is Brian Gilmore. We're at the Library of Congress, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.
This is called A Soldier Story, and it's actually from my father's twin, Wilbur Isaac, who's still alive in Baltimore, but he had a fraternal twin brother named Wilbur Isaac. His name was Wilmer Isom, so the names are almost the same. But this is told in the voice of my father. I will not die in Korea. My children born, thousands of colored men, dead like ants who have crawled too far for crumbs. Harry Truman given hell. Executive Order 9981. This is what could have been. What wasn't shall never worry. I meet the man on his grisly turf. Never meet the rising sun. So many colored men dying like middle passengers dragged here by ship. NAACP loud like locusts. Coast Guardsman Haley scratched the word. Charles Rangel Harlem hero. Hell given Harry wants to rule the world. I came down to the city of government. Learned to type. Got a good government job, GS-1 or 2, something to talk over with gin and lime. I meet a graduate of Paul Dunbar High, pretty lady who spins some tales, writes like the queen, doesn't fret about how it be. She walks behind Charles Drew, good god of blood, Jesse Fawcett, well-mannered with word. Her shorthand is a poem, civil service exam, freedom train, days full of rooms and men. She dances dark streets where she is told to stay. Her mother out pounding the pave, buying the bread, bringing the South up north for respect. Thousands write letters, send dollars for more. No more hot sun cow milk days. Fields of rice, corn cake break. World bank like crop share crooks. Trapped in bricks, but give glory to God. I didn't die in Korea. I was lucky. My children born. I was courteous to the pretty Dunbar woman. I came to the city, got a good government job, fell in love with shorthand, talked about it humbly over gin and lime. But most of all, I learned how to type.
Oh, that book is going to get taken. This is going to get published. Yeah. You know, your poems move like liquid gold. They move, and it's the short line, and it's your diction. You know, and it's the way you have changed language on the page. And I was thinking this last night, I was going over your work and what we could talk about, and I realized that you know, it used to be that Coleridge and all those people said the right word in the right order, and that was very ideological because it kept us in our place, right? Yeah. It meant we had to say a certain kind of language. Then in comes this new language with idioms and pounding the pave, you know, and the way that we introduce the real language in, that is political poetry. You know it is. What do you think? I mean, if you use language as cultural politics, I don't think the poet knows he's doing that.
I don't think so either. You know, it's like a metamorphosis in a lot of ways. I know when I first started, the thing was just to, a lot of poets who I hung out with, we were just trying to emulate some poet who we liked or something like that. But eventually, you begin to write in the manner in which, sort of like your community, like you talk, and the people you heard talk. And then that sort of fuses, I think. It fuses with what you read. But eventually, the way you talk will dominate the way in your home, the people in your neighborhood, the people you grew up with. That'll eventually dominate, and the other influence will just inform that instead of it being the other way around.
That's good.
Where you sort of leave who you are and you become something totally different. I think eventually you'll go back, and I think Kamal Braithwaite, who's one of my favorite poets, I think he's a perfect example of somebody who sort of came out. And then he sort of just has slowly drifted back to what he is. He's a Barbadian poet from the West Indies, and he knows it. And he's strong with it. Right. And that's who he is, even though he has all these other influences.
But people talk about linguistic materials. You don't think about things like that. But the jargon you are using is changing American poetry.
Right. That's a compliment.
That's pretty good.
That's a very nice compliment.
A good thing to do in one lifetime, I think, besides teaching law at Howard University. He has been published in many fine periodicals, the Washington Post, for one, the Baltimore Sun, the Detroit Free Press, the Charlotte Observer, the Buffalo News, the Rochester Democrat, the Nation, the Progressive. So you know he's a prose writer, too. He's a journalist who is a poet. What part of your brain is the analytical part, or are they both the same?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's tough. I sort of think it out the same way I do. I mean, I still do legal work, so you are faced with some point you want to make, and you figure out how to make it. Mm-hmm. In poetry, it's, you know, you do it through metaphor, mm-hmm, and examples.
But it's still making a point.
Right. But in law, you do it through the previous cases similar to this case. And it's still the same. One of my mentors, Tony Kramer, who's a very great mentor to me, he used to always say, he said, man, on that legal work, he said, you should just cut on some music. He said, it should be smooth. He said, it's got to flow out smooth. Don't let it, he said, we know you have to use the legal jargon, but you want it to flow out.
What a great thing to say.
He said, just let it, he said, it should just read. He said, when that judge picks up your paper, it should just flow out.
What good advice.
And that's really how I always look at it. You know, you want it to be, you don't want the judge or whoever's reading your paper to save somebody from eviction or whatever.
So you put on Thelonious Monk.
Right, you put on Monk or Duke or whoever you like, and you let it. He says, just let it flow out smooth.
Good.
Let it get out. Like jazz, really. Yep.
Brian Gilmore is here. He is absolutely one of our all-time favorites. And here's another poem.
It's called Malcolm X, Make It Plain, for my mother, Dorothy Shelton Gilmore. And this is about her, the whole McCarthy period and things like that. My mother laughing at government men. My father has taken a new job. With folders and documents, they're telling my mother she married Karl Marx or Engels. This is the source of her chuckling. My father, Vladimir Lenin. My father, author of the Communist Manifesto. My mother must have typed it. Disseminated copies to the workers of the world. Today, she would have emailed it as an attachment. But this is 1955, comrade, and my father's whole family is trying to laugh about it, too. They are Paul Robeson, Du Bois, Langston Hughes, or Dashiell Hammett, insisting upon handcuffs rather than a microphone. Is your father Karl Marx? They ask all of them. How do you spell proletariat? What brand of cigarettes did Lenin smoke? You mean he smoked? I hear he quit cold turkey before he died. And Karl Marx, well, comrade, didn't he play for the Brooklyn Dodgers or something? This is not funny. We know about your father, a union man, Baltimore, Maryland, tried to organize a few things, get people to band together in the workplace like ants when they see a cracker fall. He reads the People's Daily World. Your father's a bowler, right? Formed the team, and some of you were members. And at the bowling alleys, you didn't keep score. You just said, nice shot, comrade. My father's sisters and brothers no longer laugh. Two of my aunts almost lost their jobs because they could bowl. My father got interrogated for days because he knew how to pick up a spare. And my uncle, a clever man on the lanes, he spent his 2 years stint in the army in a Kansas mess hall being spied upon like he was KGB. They gave my father the documents, the records, the job. He died with those secrets. My father always liked to bowl, kicked his leg out like Earl Anthony on ABC's Wide World of Sports on Saturday afternoons. My mother liked to bowl, too. She had a purple ball and ate the cheap French fries with all that magnificent Heinz ketchup dripping slow. She couldn't stop chuckling at the government men that day. Lenin, unions, October revolutions. It is all a bit too serious. And Karl Marx, my mother says, I am sure he never played baseball.
There's a lot in that. You compress a lot of history in that. And it's never, we never know if it's a Doonesbury take, how much of it is surreal, how much of it is real. I'm almost getting able to pick it out. You enjoy that, don't you?
I just sort of just let it go where it's going to go. And I used to worry about being exact and being, now that I don't, it doesn't really bother me anymore.
But it comes back home. You always tie it up. There's a unity at the end. Look what you did with your mother at the end.
Right.
You always have kind of a built-in sense of unity. I think it's actually from your training, I don't know, it's from your academic training that you just see the symmetry is in your DNA and you go there. I don't think you plot it out.
Right, you sort of, you get
you
in and
then
you have to get out. They always talk about, I know you heard in writing, the big thing on writing is the way in. Have you heard that? You have to get in. And you say, oh, now I'm in. And you're just like, I have to get out. You have to eventually get out.
Why don't
you don't
teach
know what
writing?
Exit points are.
Why don't you teach writing?
Well, I've taught writing. I taught writing this summer for the Zora Neale Hurston, Richie Wright Foundation. I taught the teen writing. I've taught writing at, I've taught writing. I was in writer's school for 2 years.
Oh, well, yes.
I was in Catholic U. I taught writing there.
How about the Writer Center?
Well, I keep being suggested to me that I suggest a workshop.
I think so.
But I'm not as good as Ruben Jackson, who's been able to come up with his workshop.
Everyone comes at it a different way. And you come at it at a very singular way.
Right.
Which is not, you say things I've never heard before, and I've taught writing, for 50 years. But you say things in such a way that it always surprises me. And that's what people need. They need to be surprised into writing. So I definitely want you to keep doing that alongside of all of your journalism, raising three children, teaching at Howard, and writing poetry. Hey.
That's all I need to do, right?
3 o'clock in the morning.
Take care of my wife, Alana.
Brian, let's have more poetry. We're at the Library of Congress with Brian Gilmore.
And this is called Billy Bathgate. As you notice, all these poems are named after movies or television shows or what I say is moving pictures. And that sort of didn't start out that way, but it's like that. So this is called Billy Bathgate after the movie Billy Bathgate, which was also a book. All I've got is this picture. It could have been Van Der Zee, Gordon Parks, Augie Ogburn, fresh from a Chancellor Williams shoot. We are capable boys, innocent, up some small mountain in the summertime from that swamp of a city. We couldn't juggle balls, didn't know any gangsters. All we had was ice-cold Michelob and red juicy melon, holy like water. We didn't even know about the rattlesnakes that I've now been told are all over that mountain. All I've got is this picture. I could call up the crew, though some of them are gone away now like wisps of smoke. Others are here but just floating on the skyline like kite without string. We were capable boys, looking into the future as if we would live like Frederick Douglass or C.L.R. James. Did I mention the Michelob, the red juicy melon, holy like water? And how about those rattlesnakes all around us now that we know they are there? All I've got is this picture. Unbreakable smiles, lean frames, polo shirts gripping some young boys soon to be walking tightrope without poles. It's there, all of it. Ice cold Michelob, melon holy like water, rattlesnakes. We couldn't juggle balls, didn't know any gangsters. We were capable boys. All I've got is this picture.
Did it start with a picture, that poem?
It started with a picture of Sugarloaf Mountain. One day, me and my friends, we went up there. My brother took this black and white of all of us, and we were like, you know, and every time I looked at that picture one day, and it's just, you know, it's, you know.
Little did you know what was around you, though.
Right? Some people in the picture are gone. You know, they're gone. And some people are just gone from my life. Some people are gone altogether in that picture. And I look at that, and I just, you know, and we were like
capable,
in our teens.
Capable boys. But we talk about poetry vocabulary. And the way you move it, you know, did I mention, and how about, you know, that is really motion lotion, isn't it? That's how you move. And I always watch how you move through the poem.
Right.
It is those, that jargon that you put in there that just
like
greases
that.
The wheels.
I like that.
But we see it in you. And that is also, as I listened, I thought, the best writers we have are really plugged into popular culture. The music, the films, the books, aren't they?
Right.
We can't.
Consumed by it, actually. You know what I mean?
You've been formed.
It becomes probably like what the Bible was before. But even though they used the Bible as well, but they just consumed by it, like Reuben Jackson and people like that. It's just such a part of what they try to do.
And here's what he's trying to do, Brian Gilmore.
This is called Purple Rain, like the movie Purple Rain. For GJ, my roommate wants to be Merlin Perkins on Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, or Jacques Cousteau, the French deep sea diver who was cooler than Ron O'Neill dealing cocaine and Superfly. My roommate and I both want to live and die at the same time. We share this worldview as if we were born on the same date. In Washington, D.C., uptown, raised on cherry smash, soda pop, bon ton cheese, popcorn, bologna sandwiches, sweet potato pie, and AM radio emceed by Bobby Bennett. My roommate is white from Annapolis. My mother grew up with Dinah Washington singing You Go to My Head right through her kitchen window while her mother stacked homemade buttermilk biscuits next to green beans and bacon. One night, my roommate and I were coming home from the Prince Purple Rain concert on a dark road. A car began coming at us going at least 100 miles per hour. These were the days where he and I would invite the entire student body to our dorm room and try to consume all of the rum ever distilled on the island of Puerto Rico. We both grabbed the wheel of his car that night, blew the horn until we were back in our room at the dorm laughing and talking to each other in the dark of our beds until the stench from the morning paper mill forced our eyes to close. This is what we did every night of the week. This is when we found out why he wanted to chase zebras across remote regions of the earth or study the feeding habits of crocodiles and be paid for it. I never, ever tell him what I want to do. I really have no idea. Most days I just listen to Prince sing about 1999 and Judgment Day and read Rolling Stone magazine articles about how the government is killing people in Central America. Our room is full of Iron City beer, crazy B-52 songs, Ron Rico rum, and mixed up young white kids who all want to die. Mm. They remind me and my roommate each and every night when we talk in the dark is that what we want to do is live.
Mm. He's been in the Washington Review, Icarus, the Red Brick Review, The Bridge, Callaloo, Obsidian, Spirit and Flame, Cabin Fever, In Search of Color Everywhere. This is a wonderful compendium put out by Ethelbert Miller. Beyond the Frontier and Beltway, essays, reviews, everything. But when we hear your poem, the great thing about poetry is it collapses all the levels of your life so that we can time travel. We can get you as a young man. We can get you as a capable boy. We can get you as your father's son. And that's the miracle, isn't it? To compress time, and we want more miracles. Here he is, Brian Gilmore.
And this is the title poem from my latest manuscript. This is called the George Holliday Rodney King video. Dred Scott, Martin King, Rodney King, Dred King, Martin Luther Scott, Dred Luther Rodney, Rodney Luther King, Rodney Luther King, the Reverend Dr. Rodney Luther King, was pulled over last night by the Los Angeles police in Memphis, Tennessee, and taken to the Lorraine Motel. He escaped, got a few blocks down the street, but he was caught and brought back to the motel. They asked him, where did he work? He said he hadn't had a job in quite a while. Now and then he preached sermons. They told him he was lying. Dred Scott, Martin King, King Martin, King Rodney, King Dred, the King of Dred, the Reverend King Scott Martin Dred is a liar. He was free. He was on the balcony. He was unarmed. He was a minister. He was probably drunk. He was driving drunk. He was resisting. He was a resistor. He had been to the mountaintop. He was a man of peace. He wanted to march. Los Angeles, Missouri, Memphis. He had seen Wisconsin, the promised land, the court settlement. Rodney, Martin, Dred King, Scott King, a drunken liar, a man with no real job driving skills, a man who preaches an occasional sermon, almost died a slave on some balcony in Los Angeles, surrounded by cops with stun guns, batons, explanations, Supreme Court orders, caught on film by Francis Ford, Steven Spielberg, Soderbergh, Coppola, Orson, Frank Wells, Capra. That is exactly how it happened. I watched it without any buttered popcorn. Some loud, drunken minister resisting arrest in the 19th century. A war will be fought over a movie. Chances Are by Johnny Mathis is the theme song. Anybody seen Ken Burns? Flashdance for Adanya. Like me, she's having a little trouble with rhythm. She's not always on the one like George Clinton. Her mother has the cure. A James Brown box set all day in the house now. It is helping me too. Haven't you heard? Papa's got a brand new bag.
That is it. That's the voice of Brian Gilmore. And it pounds in your chest like a heart. His poetic argument is of history, his own history and the world's history, and he makes it bigger than the world. That's the miracle. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We've been featuring Brian Gilmore, and he is a poet, he's a lawyer, and he's changing things with his poetic argument. I'm Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and we are back with Brandon Johnson, and he's the author of a new book. It's called Love Skin, and we're going to hear from this today. He lives in Washington. I don't know where he's been all my life, but he's here today. Here's Brandon.
Listen, lust can beat men to mud. Some learn from calm women on cool sheets hard as day-old grits. She left a bathroom wall message in rouge. He won't touch his records, blues men telling him what he couldn't hear before. Somewhere, lips print a cigarette. Low tones chase smoke from her mouth, crawl into the ear of another man. Now he hears the sound of somebody else's arm snaking round the waist of a red dress.
Beautiful. That's Brandon Johnson. Tell us a little bit about this book, how you characterize it. If someone just said, what's that book about?
Well, Love Skin is essentially the sausage casing of love. There are no love poems in the book. It's about the things that make up love, the the things you want to happen. That's why I've got it broken up into three parts. It ain't what you want. It's what you get that makes you fat. And so the first part is about what people think are those things that are going on in a relationship and maybe not. And the second part is a series of 16 poem series about a triangle, not necessarily all of it love. And then the third is what makes you fat is those things that actually do happen, those things that you some people come to realize and some things that don't turn into all that great of a situation.
Okay, prove it. Here he goes. Brandon Johnson of the Library of Congress.
Gasoline. The dividing line strobe against the gray pavement, the high hum of snow tires, the limbo of being between stations, and Diane's voice switching between rant and whine. We're doing a better job of driving Braxton closer to insanity than he was of driving them home. He had to get out of that car or risk keeling over in Diane's lap, killing them both. It might have been easier to do that than get back behind the wheel and wait for her crescendo, a World War II air raid siren reminding him the war was not over, that burning his fortress was not complete until he understood clearly that she would not forget him dancing with his high school sweetheart, all strappy heels and cleavage, thick thighs and groins, noses and lips too close to each other after 15 years. Their song permeating the air like a familiar scent, while everyone at the reunion looked on wistfully, recalling drive-ins, sweaty vinyl seats, and the good old days. As Braxton filled up the tank, dusted off the rear lights, checked the oil, the tires, the washer fluid, and anything else he could check from the outside, he knew 3 hours more would feel like six, and ponders, you can't hear a thing when fire engulfs your head, can you?
Brandon, there is such music in that, and I wouldn't even mention it if I didn't know that was a prose poem. Mm. Now, that's the interesting thing. People say, what is a prose poem? And we don't know, but we know it has to have that tight lyricism inside those lines that are from margin to margin. And when I was listening to that, that thing is so musical. And has anyone told you how sensual that is for a prose poem?
Thanks.
Beautiful. You don't even need the line lengths to make that thing balance. He is author of Love Skin, Man Burns Ant, The Strangers Between, and co-author of The Black Rooster Social Inn, This is the Place. He's been published in many places, The Drumming Between Us, Fodder Wing, Kowaloo, Gargoyle, Red Brick Review, Potomac Review, and many anthologies. And we have been wanting to have him on for a very long time, so this is our chance. Here's Brandon.
This poem is from The Strangers Between. Trouble Man. You're a high school court god. Syncopate spheres, interpolate values with a 10-foot constant. Bump your head on the backboard. You come up hard. You lace cons, gladiator chainmail. This is sovereign country. Colors blaze leather sleeves. But your shots don't drop. You come apart. No honor catching bench splinters. You come apart. Want to throw wood, want to burn rubber, want to sweat. But you know the rules. Hopeless deity, this is not your world. Your eyes penetrate the autobiography. Angry men die. Wars fume from kitchen table televisions. You come up hard. B-ball games end. Cars slip into darkness. Submarines on patrol. You come up. Climb new heights on hemp ladders. Quart bottles. Refract night hard. You come apart. Trouble Man struts rear window speakers. You sing along with Marvin. Chant war songs. Allowanced boys learn inner city blues. Cisco is that brother round the corner. This you know, baby.
Where did you get your phrases? You just know so much about music, don't you?
Well, I try. I'm always loved music, and music has always been part of any of the most of the poems that I write.
Absolutely.
You Come Apart, or You Come Up Hard, is actually from a Marvin Gaye song titled Trouble Man. Also interesting for me is that in high school, some of the guys who weren't exactly my friends called me T-Man or Trouble Man. Also, this is really about my high school existence, talking about the autobiography of Malcolm X and the Vietnam War being on the television. And
all within one small poem. But the phrasing of it, just, I just said, this man, you must play an instrument as well. That's right.
I played a trumpet in high school.
Mm-hmm. Something is showing. Brandon Johnson is here. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. And he is a poet. He is an administrator. He has his Juris Doctorate, which he tells me is just a law degree, from Antioch School of Law. And he is living in Washington, D.C. with his family, but not originally. Gary, Indiana?
Gary, Indiana. Yeah.
I remember that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Here Steel he goes. Town.
Steel Town. But we're so happy to have you. Don't go away. This is Brandon Johnson, and he's got a way that I haven't heard before. And I guess that is the one thing they can't do to us is make poetry sound like anything else.
Past time. I zigzag sidewalks, shunning landmine gym shoes. Hear chanted anthems of long-dead rappers between broken glass and chewing gum. Buildings grow beards before they collapse under secret acts spilling from windows. I don't look into alleys. Dead-eyed men walk with babies' cries in their hands. My woman sits in an empty hotel room. Lamps give life to shadows. Needless duties waylay me. Detours created by my deficits. This is the night of at last, and I'm not there to help her breathe. Candles and Cassandra fade. Cheese hardens. Crackers don't anymore. She's a decumbent Coke bottle crushing plush pile like the furniture. A man can learn a lot watching a couch do its job. I see Melly first. A man nasty as blues song sung for sassy women. He's scripping to his boys, standing round a fire, embers spiraling past frostbite like lightning bugs headed for the moon. Downtown phrases slide from his lips, hot rods on an icy road, a midnight cold as the hawk slipping under a girl's skirt. Men like us don't know when to shut up, neither knowing when to be bested or accept a coup de grace gracefully. Daddy's reps are ground underfoot. Mamas need to know better than come into a hungry man's mind when he's scheming. We dozen so hard, family trees fall like shifting cards in the hands of a Times Square Monty artist. Men like us don't know when to shut up. It's like standing room only at a theater in a round out here. The periphery catches shrapnel. A laughing crony's sister bites the dust. Errant bombs nick the noses of ne'er-do-wells and neighbors out to catch the spectacle before cops make rounds. Barbed hands ease trade tools from waistbands and sweat socks. Melly lifts a 40, quashes the rumble before damage is done. When his eyes begin to float, I'm gone. I ease toward the curb. A pair of tight jeans glowing at the edge of the fire remind me of my destination. A streetlight wobbles when I pass. The light makes night a Harryhausen invention. My woman's angry as a moth beating porch light for sun. Chocolate soften on unsullied pillowcases. The hawk rattles windows asking to be her lover. Lays down feelings easier than I ever wanted to. She snatches the do not disturb sign. Thinks the bellman might need a new babe to escort. Why lose black lace and scalloped borders to the cleaning lady? Clock hands point the way out. She knows nothing's coming in before night ends its solitary shift.
Brandon Johnson, a man can learn a lot watching a couch do its job.
Yeah.
There is so much humor inside of your lines. Do you think that way? Is that the
when
way
I'm
you
writing,
think?
Yeah, I do. That's the thing, is that a lot of times lines just come out of of a thought and you go, oh, and you write it down. I keep a piece of, I always keep a pad in my back pocket so that I can ever always write down things if I get an idea.
Well, the way you combine them is like a Legos, making mm-hmm. Legos, which mm-hmm. make a beautiful structure from all these different colors and shapes and sizes, but it all works out. Fact and reason are still at the heart of it. It all works. Is that because you were trained in a scholarly manner so that you, at the heart of you, you have order?
Well, interestingly enough for me, I look at everything as a movie. And so I'm always constructing movies or stories in my head. I tell stories. I rarely write personal poems because I don't really want to tell those stories yet. But I'm always looking at, I look at it as extrapolating from what I see of somebody. Being from Gary, Indiana, and I constructed a lot of characters. A lot of the things that my stories have come from are my ideas of Steel Town mm-hmm. and characters and people that I've either known or known of because my father worked in the steel mill. And in fact, when I told him about one of the particular poems that I've written, he was telling me about something, and I incorporated it, something about one of his best friends.
But the magic is turning it into folklore, because it's an industrial town. We don't usually think of Gary, Indiana, as being the heart of folklore, maybe Atlanta or something. And that's what you do. You're aware of that, right?
I appreciate you saying that. I definitely want to look at it as folklore.
It's lovely, yeah. Brandon Johnson, Grace Cavalieri together. And it's the first time, but not the last, we're at the Library of Congress. He's moving into another book, it seems like. This is Strangers?
Strangers.
How do you think that's different from your newer one? What have you learned?
How to think in order of how to construct an arc throughout the poems. In particular, with Love Skin, the first section and all three of the sections have an arc. They may not have the same poem, I mean the same story, but they go through a process. Like the first poem, Listen, is really sets the tone for the rest of that section.
Music again.
And blues poems. That's where I really
that's operate
your
folklore.
From is blues. Boy Scout motto. Sydney crept through back doors like a thief. Another man's midnight shift was good for a hound who didn't bay at moons, walked the wild side of working stiff's sheets. But tonight, a suspicious husband stepped light, back home early with a heavy hand. His doors worked with him, shushed their hinges. A bullet ran past Sydney's ear, whispered his name. A wife screamed, grabbed cover, a dame searching for chastity in a whore's house. Glass scattered like roaches in lit kitchens. He hopped the bed, ran past red eyes that had sooner dropped Sydney in a bucket of bubbling steel as fill him with lead. Barefoot, buck naked, hauling enough ass to leave Jesse Owens eating dust, skipping downstairs, up street, round corner to car, anxious key waiting to be turned, spare Stacy standing on the back seat, fresh drawers cooling it, folded in the glove box. Sydney knew being prepared ain't just a Boy Scout's motto. His T-bird tipped off the block like a burglar on rounds, headlights out. The driver, gangster leaning as if he hadn't just raced the devil. The moon wasn't a spy, and his socks weren't under that bed with his wallet.
Let's have another. You like to go back and forth from book to book?
Sometimes.
As the urge strikes you.
Right.
This is a pretty book. Love Skin is, first of all, the color of it. I don't know where they ever got that paint. It's indigo. And then your wife took the photograph on the cover.
Yes.
Is she a professional photographer?
Yes, she is.
Wow.
And the color is the color of the photograph. I mean, that's...
Oh, actually.
Yeah. She took this picture years ago, and I loved it from the first time I saw it. And it was really The Guide. It was the original title of the manuscript was Blue Muse, based on the color of the photo, and through a lot of things, a lot of processes.
And Reuben Jackson says Brandon Johnson's poem Shack Up with the Blues and recast every terse, lyrical, and emotional detail present in its locket. So we want to hear some more. This is From Love's Skin.
This is a pantoum. It's a form where the second and fourth lines of the preceding stanza become the first and third lines of the next stanza. This is called Juke Tomb. Butler looks across the dance floor at Odette and Smallwood, racks his brain for a way out this four-cornered room, the box blaring love song sad men can't stand. Det runs a red nail down the rippling bicep busting from Wood's t-shirt. We crack nuts quiet. Our beers hit bottom like oil slicks. But in this four-cornered room, the box blaring love song sad men can't stand, Butler beats a steady rhythm, keeping time with the Roscoe in his hand, fingers turning blue as the gun. We crack nuts quiet. Our beers hit bottom like oil slicks. But Odette sees Butler last, her giving Smallwood pouty lip signals even a blind man couldn't confuse. Butler beats a steady rhythm, keeping time with the Roscoe in his hand, fingers turning blue as the gun. Him thinking about the rack in his truck, how two barrels will do the job quicker. But Odette sees Butler last, her giving Smallwood pouty lip signals even a blind man couldn't confuse. Butler's shaking, beer sloshing, the room's frying like eggs on asphalt. Him thinking about the rack in his truck, how two barrels will do the job quicker, but light glares, night splits like the seams in that big girl's halter. Butler's shaking, beer sloshing, the room's frying like eggs on asphalt. Jukebox buzzes between records, Brogans creak boards, everybody steps to one side or the other. Lights glare. Night splits like the seams in that big girl's halter. Det runs a red nail down the rippling bicep busting from Wood's t-shirt. Jukebox buzzes between records. Brogans creak boards. Everybody steps to one side or the other when Butler runs across the dance floor past Odette and Smallwood, rack in the back, not far away.
There's danger. There's danger in some of your work.
Yes. That's a part of the thing about folklore and blues and just telling a story is to have something that there's an event. There's something that's going on. And that's.
Well, you write ballads. That's what I think. You write ballads. And I just got in touch with that when I was listening to that. I love this. Love songs sad men can't stand.
Yeah.
Gee, that is good. Did you feel that when you, have you ever heard something say, I'm just too sad to hear that music? Is that where that came from?
Oh, yeah. There are certain songs that I had to get over it, but there were certain songs that were definitely related to events in my life.
And they hurt. Yeah.
And
And look what happened. Because of that experience, a line in a poem came out. Love songs sad men can't stand, so that it was a small, tiny drop inside of you, and now it is larger than life. Pretty cool. Let's have another something. This is Brandon Johnson, and I am Grace Cavalieri. It is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and we are celebrating our 30th year on air, and Brandon's helping to do that.
Valentine's Day. Now comes night, and I fight the moon. My shield is transparent as pain. I close narrow blinds to obstruct the truth, but my windows are pierced by bright knives. I use shadow to hide my detachment. This beacon makes light of my ploy. I run behind tables and long-legged chairs, dodge rays like a child playing games. The moon yanks my eyelids with hooks of light, my back burned blue by blazing beams. I crouch in the corner, turn my face to the wall, pretend the empty bed is an illusion. Red House. Rocking in heat waves, folks lounging on porches. A baby lifts his mama's skirt. From the corner, Curtis eyeballs stocking tops. Blue bandana blots sweat from gritty neck. Now he's at the door, easing his key into a lock. But things change when you ain't looking. A woman's perfume, the color of her hair. Key don't turn him, thinking Lisa's gone. Him confused his uncut hair. She's there, but new keys ride another man's pocket. New funk lies on the bed. Good behavior couldn't get Curtis free soon enough. But wasn't 99 days lost his place at the table? New shoes sat by the footboard after 13. On the sidewalk, his eyes match house paint. Shirt sticks to skin like paper on fudgesicles. A Chevy glides the crossroad, a baseline chopping air. BB's telling the world the thrill is gone, and Curtis remembers every sad song he laid on Lisa. Sees the blues man's voice twirling out her mouth like dust behind the car, her head wagging like a hula doll's. Impala lowrides. A flowered blue scarf licks the sky. Bottom fades under gravel's growl. A cord bends down the road. Lisa has a sister. Uptown.
Does every poem have a new character?
No, actually, this particular poem has a follow-up that deals with the folks in the Chevy, and then there's a poem in the first section of Love Skin that deals with a woman named Cletha, who then becomes part of a much longer poem called At Junie's in the third part.
But does it matter? I mean, if we don't read one poem, we can still enjoy the other?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
But you're pretty well populated. You are. That book is pretty well populated with people.
Yeah. Finding names for folks is probably the hardest part of it.
You didn't want to use the real names?
Well, there aren't real people.
Yeah. That's good. Well, let's leave it right there and go right on. That says a lot about poetry, although he balances the tension of all these people. It feels like real.
Thanks. That first Red House was based on a song by Jimi Hendrix. This is Gypsy Woman. Chevy leaning into curves, cruising on a steel man's wages, dual exhausts gurgling past furnace stacks. A blue scarf holding down Mavis's dew. Cedric drives slow as sipping whiskey, smooth as Mayfield moaning gypsy woman, looking sideways through shades at her dark profile. This school teacher didn't usually run with Cedric's kind. He ain't looking for picket fences or rugrats, but together they're pulled to the villa, the blue room, like a compass north, soaking life in like their jobs paid them to party. Mavis go with Cedric like pocket hankies, but watching her bop in the dark, skirt unfurling like a bullfighter's cape, he was hypnotized with love, knowing this flitting moth didn't bump her head against false suns on midnight porches. Mavis vibed on moving, feet flowing, fingers tangling, sound soaking her soul like lotion on ashy skin, not caring when she'd get enough. Cedric was cool enough to wait. She'd get tired of the night. He'd twist her hips slow on the dance floor, hold her heart close to his, whisper dreams to his gypsy like a fortune teller. He knew how to watch water boil, pay little attention, glance off and on, until steam rises like sap in a spring tree promising leaves.
You know, your similes are so rural, like leaves, and like I was just thinking that so many of your poems, they had trees in Gary, Indiana.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Brandon was twice a Larry Neal Writers Competition awardee. Did they know you won the first time when you won the second time?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And he has had fellowships from the D.C. Commission on the Arts and Humanities. Is a Cave Canem Workshop Graduate Fellow. Was Toy Derricott there or Cornelius Eady?
Yes.
Both of them were in residence?
Oh, yes.
Must have been
fabulous. They're the founders of it, and they are the lifeblood of the organization.
They are. I remember when they found the name of that, they stumbled across something in Italy.
Yeah, they were in Pompeii.
Yeah.
And they were at the, it's the house of the, I can't remember if it's the lost poet, but there was a sign that said, Cave Canem, which means beware of the dog.
Right.
And that's what our logo is a dog with a chain that's broken.
What a wonderful thing they've done.
Mm-hmm. Murder of crows fills the line between poles, your empty chair.
Can we have a final poem?
This is a poem about my muse, amused. I turn corners hoping to smack into you. I wait in subways for your escalator hum sachet. I save a seat in stadiums yearning your long-fingered caress. When we sit amidst large crowds, the clatter is a shield around our whispers, as if you and I are alone, the only figures of interest cohabiting an impressionist-modeled mayhem. As if, see, you do this to me. These moments when I'm a minister marrying word to image, where weary Lexis rustled from slumber become the cast of thousands for a picture's worth. I'm afraid to recite your names, afraid to reveal a secret identity, force you to hide where I might see you only out the corner of my eye. Because of our time-to-time kisses, in anger, you'd fix me, banish what I can't recall to surf the tip of my tongue forever. Sometimes I fear I'll invoke the wrong spell and you'll move to the neighborhood in my brain where I've been barred, where if I knocked, you'd hide behind the door as if I were selling cosmetics or cosmology. So I say things that won't offend to define you, share only the most public details with my friends, savor our moments together like a deep, sweet mug of tea. I rest my lips on your hem. Words high dive off my shoulder, make small splashes on the page while you and I lie as old lovers do. Amused, we can still break the surface, leave a bead of blood behind.
Amused. That was the voice of Brandon Johnson, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Production is by Forest Woods Media. Post-production is by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. Associate producer is Kenneth Flynn. We wish to thank the Broadcasting, Motion Picture, and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. The Witterbinner series is brought to you with assistance from the WordWorks, publishing in contemporary poetry and presenting public programs in Washington, D.C. since 1975, and funded by the Witterbinner Foundation for Poetry. Our engineer is Brad McCoy. I'm Grace Cavalieri.